al-Zawawi would attend every single event where there was a possibility of discussing the situation of Palestine and shedding light on the atrocities of the Zionist regime. During his tenure in Tehran, he also played an important role as diplomat. We have lost a very good friend.
During his years-long battle against the Zionist occupiers of Palestine and several decades of diplomatic activities in Iran, Zawawi always fought to safeguard the rights of oppressed Palestinians and keep the Palestinian cause alive.
According to all of our agreements, we are completely against normalizing ties with Israel. This is something that Mr. al-Zawawi stood up for. He made a lot of speeches discussing why it's absolutely wrong to normalize ties with Israeli occupiers of our land.
The late Salah al-Zawawi was like a father to all of us in the resistance front. He dedicated his life to uniting Palestinians and fighting for the freedom of our land. He wanted every single inch of Palestine to be free. May he rest in peace.
I met Mr. al-Zawawi 3 years ago when I first arrived in Tehran to serve as Syria's ambassador. But I knew him long before that. In Syria, he was a very well-known figure because of his political views and speeches. Not only did he advocate Palestinian rights, but he also played an important role in strengthening the ties of Arab countries.
To many people, Salah al-Zawawi was an icon, a role model. But to his family, he was a loving father and grandfather, too.
My grandfather was not just a leader and an ambassador. He wasn't just great at his job. He was a great person at home with his family. He was a great father, he was a great grandfather, and he was a great friend. He will be missed because, honestly, his presence was such a great influence for all of us. He was lovely, he was funny, he was motivational, and he was strong.
Throughout his career, Salah al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, efforts that, according to him, had eventually made a point with the occupiers.
It is very clear to them that the people of Palestine will never forget its land. Not in 1948 and in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and 1948, we will never forget our land.
This is probably why Palestinians of all backgrounds take his loss heavily.
Salah al-Zawawi served as a Palestinian ambassador to Tehran for more than four decades. He was the second Palestinian ambassador since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. He was also among the founding members of the Fatah movement. He will always be remembered as an influential figure in the fight against Israeli occupation. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Haynes Grunberg, has been busy this week meeting with Yemeni and UAE officials in the Emirates. The UN Envoy's office posted a tweet stating that the latest efforts are aimed at improving Yemen's living conditions and securing longer-term peace, security, and development. Given the UN's track record in Yemen, it behooves one to raise some questions about what security, peace, and development look like through the political lens of the United Nations. I visited Mohammed al-Nu'aymi, a member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, to hear his take on the UN's progress in establishing security, lasting peace, and development in Yemen.
The United Nations' efforts and strategies in most of the nations they have been involved in have focused on two main efforts. The first effort is gathering intelligence for Western nations because it is the West who controls the UN. The second effort is to pave the way for Western states to implement their political agenda. For example, in Yemen, they want to control the country's political affairs and geography. If they are unable to achieve this, their second option is to divide Yemen.
Al-Nu'aymi also said the UN and its partners' political ambitions are not limited to Yemen.
They are not just planning to divide Yemen. They are planning to fragmentize the entire region, including the states that are helping them in this effort. For example, they are planning to divide Egypt into three states and Saudi Arabia into five states.
Abdel Khalik Qobar, a Yemeni judge I spoke with, said cases of war crimes should be filed against members of the United Nations, who he says are actively engaged in covering up the crimes against humanity perpetuated on Yemenis. In his televised speech last week, leader of Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, called on the Yemeni people to be prepared for war in case peaceful efforts fail to bring about the Yemeni people's demands. The UN claims to be engaged in peaceful efforts to bring an end to the conflict in Yemen. However, according to Ansarullah officials, the UN body has been engaged in efforts to divide countries in the region. Officials we spoke with believe this is part of a greater plan which aims to prevent the Muslim world from uniting against Western imperialism. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia. Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
They said they were in it for the long haul, and they have kept their promise. Thousands of ambulance drivers from two separate unions walking off the job across much of England and Wales. Their demand, a pay award that keeps pace with the rising cost of living. The message, that the service is already stretched beyond its limit. Mondays are typically the busiest day for ambulance services across the country, with people now advised to use the 991 service only in an emergency. Despite the disruption, public support for the strikers is strong.
I live with two ambulance drivers and a nurse, so my answer is yes, they deserve more. I think they need more pay, yes.
We're very lucky the people that are working in the hospitals are nice enough to carry on working during the pandemic and not strike earlier, to be fair, because we needed them, they were there when we needed them, and when they need us, we're not there for them, sort of thing. So I think it's a shame.
Despite being on strikes, the crew still leave the picket lines to respond to emergency calls. But the message is, even serious calls will face substantial delays.
The strike action by NHS staff has only intensified in recent weeks, with multiple other walkouts planned for next month. Another single biggest day of action will be the beginning of March, when nurses will once again walk off the job, just like ambulance drivers are doing today.
The unions insist the solution is in the government's hands, a pay increase of about 10%. In the case of nurses, 5% above inflation, that's stubbornly in the double digits. Yet the man holding the strings to the public purse, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says that's not affordable.
Government spend lots of money on other things, even NHS-wise, that needn't be spent, that could be paying the people that look after everybody, yeah.
February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. Saeed Bourza, London.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran. The most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What was made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. 1 year passes since Russia started what it called a special military operation in Ukraine. Moscow said the West's eastward expansion up to Russia's doorstep and the suffering of ethnic Russian people in eastern Ukraine had forced it to take up arms in order to demilitarize and denazify the regime in Kiev. Russia annexed four eastern regions of Ukraine but has not achieved its goals yet. The West keeps supplying weapons to Kiev, but still not enough to change the balance on the battlefield. What does the West gain from a prolonged war in Ukraine? We'll try to bring to the spotlight some hidden aspects of the war in Ukraine with our guests. Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joining us from Ossining, New York. And also, we have independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. 1 year on from the start of this war, Kremlin says it launched the war in response to NATO's eastward expansion. On the other hand, Kiev and the West maintain that the war was unprovoked. What has been achieved by Russia, which outlined its objectives for this so-called special military operation in Ukraine?
Well, the first thing that's been achieved is that they have let NATO and the United States know that they're not going to be allowed to drive tanks directly into Moscow without a fight. Starting with the promise not to cross the Elbe back in the late 80s, when the Soviet Union was and remains the only occupying party of the four powers that occupied Germany to actually end their occupation and bring their troops home. The U.S. has since then moved steadily towards Russia's borders, including parts of the Soviet Union in NATO. NATO's guns are pointed at Russia. They're not pointed anywhere else. And Russia knows this. They have brains, first of all. A child would understand this. They also have satellite surveillance of, you know, everything that goes on the ground. And the U.S. and NATO haven't been shy about declaring what their actual intention is. And so, number one, what they've done is say that we drew a red line and we're defending the red line and we're going to prosecute it. And now, with an announcement that Transnistria is not going to be permitted to go in play, they're actually moving that line forward some. They had sought peacefully to sort of unwind this NATO invasion force at their doorstep back in December of 2021. The U.S. refused that. And as recently as today, Jens Stoltenberg, looking at a peace proposal from China, rejected it out of hand, saying that of all the countries in the world, the most populous and one of the wealthiest ones, according to this knucklehead, lacks credibility to try to broker peace. So, you know, we have seen fantasy dictate policy on the West, and I think what Russia has achieved more than anything is to introduce a taste of reality into how the U.S. deals with the world.
Gilbert Doctorow, Russia has accused Western countries of pursuing, quote, destructive policies by supplying Kiev with weapons and training. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that Western countries are exploiting Ukraine and using its people as, quote, cannon fodder. The foreign minister also recently said that Washington has subjugated Europe in order to wage war against Moscow. Walk us through these comments, please.
I think the last comment is the most valuable. Indeed, on February 24th, it became manifestly apparent to all 27 heads of state in Europe that they were unprepared militarily to face down Russia. And without strong American presence in Europe, Europe was defenseless. How this came about, given that in the last 10, 20 years, the collective military budgets of all the European Union were 5-10 times greater than Russia, how it came about that these countries all lacked any military means to oppose Russia should it take an interest in striking against Europe, that is a separate question. But the sham of NATO became apparent. Whatever else we can say, Europe was submitted itself to American domination and diktats, which are destroying the European economy, precisely because Europe had done nothing in the past 20 years to prepare itself to defend itself in a way that reflects European and not American interests. So that is one of the most important results of one year of war, that Europe has rolled over and died.
Don DeBar, Russia's UN ambassador, says the West is ready not only to sacrifice Ukraine, but also to plunge the entire world into the abyss of war just to defeat Russia. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. Anyone looking at it clearly does. Look, at the beginning of this, for clarity's sake, President Putin, Foreign Minister Lavrov, a host of others, significant Russian officials who speak authoritatively said, here is our nuclear weapons use doctrine. One, we will retaliate in kind to a nuclear attack. And two, if we need to, we will use nuclear weapons to prevent the taking down of the Russian state. And since that moment, the U.S. has declared in one way or another, first with Biden saying it, then walking it back, but State Department holding seminars on things like decolonizing Russia and stuff, that this, in fact, is their aim. In fact, we had the Prime Minister of Estonia over the past few days saying, in essence, that NATO needs to take control of, occupy Moscow, and re-educate the Russian people so that they're not a threat to the neighborhood anymore. I don't know how much more directly one could summon up nuclear war than that.
Mr. Doctorow, there were claims last year hinting that U.S. clandestine operations inside Ukraine are now far more extensive than they were early in the war, when U.S. intelligence officials, this is according to the report, were fearful that Russia would steamroll over the Ukrainian army. Is this just what the U.S. and NATO wanted all along, for this conflict to be a prolonged one and to see it dragged on for as long as possible in the hope that it weakens Russia?
Well, the probability of this being a long war is relatively low. At this point, the Russians are close to making some very important military progress in their attempts to take the entire Donbass. We will see in the next few days that Bakhmut falls. Bakhmut has made it, this nexus of logistical nexus was made an important defensive fortification of the Ukrainian side, and it is, and they have lost 20,000 troops defending it, and it's about to go, opening the path to Russia's occupation, as I said, of the full extent of the Donbass, which would be a very important military victory. A long war, yes, of course, the United States wants that. It provoked and pitted Russia and Ukraine against one another in the same way that once upon a time it pitted and provoked Iran and Iraq into a war that was devastating for both sides. This particular war is devastating for one side. Of course, the Russians have casualties, but the Ukrainian casualties have been much more severe because of the obtuse defense of various points which should have been evacuated if the regime in Kiev had any interest in the lives of its own citizens. It doesn't. And so the war was intended to be destructive of Russia's military force because it put Russia against a peer, a country with a military in scale and in training. In the last 8 years, it's been trained and disciplined by NATO instructors. It pitted Russia against a country that was similar in capabilities, if not in scale or size. So this, the that, as I said, the war is being decided on the battlefield. The Russians, at this moment, seem to have the upper hand on the battlefield, and therefore the likelihood of this going on very long is reasonably low.
Don DeBar, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were in fact parties to the conflict. Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nebenzia recently said that it's the collective West that is waging the war in Ukraine, not Ukraine itself. The question is, will this support result in this conflict probably spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger? There have been, of course, threats of nuclear retaliation on several occasions.
You know, first of all, the chance of having a global war is not exactly the same as the chance of having a nuclear war. So people that think that there's a low chance of having a nuclear war because even the crazy elites wouldn't blow up their own world, you hear that argument all the time with just regular folks. It is quite possible, as a matter of fact, and I'm certain that there are people who are doing military planning who believe this, whether it's true or not, to have a global war with conventional weapons. And by the way, with the exception of the radioactive fallout, it's not clear that the use of conventional weapons would be that much less destructive than nuclear weapons, in that if you're blowing all the same stuff up, whether you use nuclear weapons or not, the material goes into the atmosphere, you have nuclear winter, all kinds of other effects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've seen in Iraq, for example, what depleted uranium can do. So, you know, you have that happening on the one hand. On the other, in terms of the actual policy making that's going on, first of all, there's a game of chicken that is like laying in front of the U.S. military planners. Assuming, as I do also, that the analysis is correct and that there's a strategic victory really in the offing, if not a major tactical one, in favor of Russia, the U.S. has been incrementally taking one step after another that's more overtly aggressive towards Russia, to the extent that Ambassador Nebenzia said the other day, you know, we see what's going on and we're going to be dealing with that in kind at some point. There's going to be a point in time when these actions require a response that takes place not in Ukraine or even Transnistria, but perhaps in Germany or New York. And at that point in time, everything becomes extremely unpredictable. And as against that, the kind of sanity we hear is from people like Ursula von der Leyen is that because China doesn't side with the United States and criticize Russia, that China is on Russia's side rather than being a neutral player. I mean, the entire board is so skewed. These people are buying their own propaganda as fact. It's hard to see how anyone is going to make a sane decision in the face of the gambles that are being taken at an increasingly broader and deeper rate.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gilbert Doctorow, Russia says Western military aid to Ukraine, including the additional tanks, changes nothing on the ground. Kremlin spokesman has said Moscow has repeatedly warned that such aid will only add more problems for Ukraine and its people. Give us your assessment on the issue.
Well, the point that the Russians are making is that the longer the range of offensive weapons the West gives to Ukraine, the the greater the necessity of the Russian forces to move, to push to the frontier as far to the west as possible to keep their own territory out of range of those new weapons. The logic is that if the United States persists in providing ever longer missiles and other offensive weapons, possibly jets, then the Russia will move straight to the Polish border, which is what Mr. Medvedev claimed today could be a necessity. That so the numbers of tanks and so forth that are being provided to Ukraine are only a political gesture for the home audience in Poland, in the United States, and in other individual countries that have provided this equipment. Whether it's 10, 20, 100 tanks, the Ukrainians have lost several thousand tanks, and they have been reprovided with many tanks, and again, numbering in hundreds of thousands, coming from stockpiles in Eastern Europe. None of that has helped. They've mostly been destroyed. Therefore, the incremental value of these systems is a nuisance value, not a factor that will change the outcome of the war. What is important, I'd like to comment on this whole nuclear issue. I think that President Putin would never have initiated this conflict if he had not been confident that Russia has a first strike capability against the United States. And I think there may even be a few sage minds in the Pentagon who understand that perfectly. The Russians rolled out 3 years ago, 4 years ago, a whole series of new offensive weapon systems that have no peers. Their nuclear drone Poseidon undersea, their various hypersonic missiles, including those that circle the globe and would attack the United States from its underbelly, from the south. All of these weapons are devastating and potentially give Russia a first strike capability. Of course, nobody is foolish enough to risk a nuclear war on the chance that it will stop all the weapons of its opponent. There is that lingering consideration that there would be the famous haircut of 30, 40, or 40 million people of your own country who would be killed in such a conflict. Just if I then go back to the 1960s film on this subject, Dr. Strangelove. So the United States will not push this to a nuclear war because it knows that it's at a disadvantage. That came out clearly in Mr. Sure. Putin's speech 2 days ago.
Donovan, let's rewind back to April of last year. Multiple U.S. sources said Russian and Ukrainian negotiators appeared to have agreed on a peace deal, but then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that from taking place. Boris Johnson reportedly told the Ukrainian president that even if Ukraine is ready, Kiev's Western backers are not. Why would they not be ready for peace? And was that an opportunity missed, in your opinion?
You have to consider what is the objective of the United States through all of this. The U.S. engineered the installation of the current Ukrainian government and, as a matter of fact, had a heavy hand in installing a lot of the other governments along that border in the Baltics and even in Poland, Czechoslovakia, now Czech Republic of Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, etc. Boris Johnson, not so coincidentally perhaps, is apparently vying for the Secretary General's job at NATO to replace Stoltenberg when they sent him back to whatever ward he came from. And so perhaps that's what motivated him. But the U.S. apparently has had a goal pretty much off the pages of Mein Kampf that Hitler penned in his jail cell in 1922 or whatever, looking at the natural resources of Russia as, you know, the next Africa or Asia or Latin America, and the labor force there as, you know, whatever, the next middle passage workers in the, you know, for the industry, information age. The U.S. policy, I would say probably the longest running project in the history of mankind, compressed into 20th and 21st century times, because the pyramids took a lot longer, with the biggest budget has been to knock down the Russian government and make it a puppet of the West, the UK and the US in particular, beginning with the installation of American troops and British troops in Russia during World War I. Certainly in the post-war period, the U.S. military was positioned and targeted at the Soviet Union. And after capturing it for a brief moment in the 1990s, that's been the objective of the United States again, from Georgia to Armenia and Azerbaijan and the Baltics and wherever else, and a creep of NATO. It appears now that they intend to go for it. Looked like they were trying while Obama was president, and there was a brief pause in that project when Trump became president for whatever reason. But now they're going for the gusto. They've got the hot war going on at the border. They're shooting into Russia already. I mean, they are about three-quarters of the way into Russia as far as Hitler got, with the exception of Belarus and Kazakhstan, and they went for that in 2021. You had attempted color revolutions in both places. So it seems they're going for it. They're also, again, the State Department is holding seminars like Decolonizing Russia, looking back to the 17th century nationalities that were there and looking to restore the nation states to, you know, do what was done to Yugoslavia to Russia. Russia said, if that happens, we use nukes. You go for that, we use nukes. And they're doing it. They're going for it.
Giver, Doctor, Western countries have called on China, for example, not to help Russia, including by undermining international sanctions or in the past by even justifying Moscow's actions in Ukraine. There have been threats of sanctions directed at other countries that are accused of helping Russia. Do you think that this could be a hypocritical stance, maybe a classic do as I say but not as I do scenario?
Well, I think characterizing it as hypocrisy is not a very strict condemnation. Hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy in general. What we have here is rank stupidity. The United States has, for the last 10 years, pursued an incredibly obtuse policy of trying to take on both Russia and China at the same time. That has not stopped. And what you've just described a moment ago, the criticism of China and the preparation for imposition of secondary sanctions on China for alleged violation of U.S. sanctions on Russia, this will create a military alliance between Russia and China, which does not presently exist and does not have to exist, and certainly is against the better wishes of the Chinese government. But this idiocy is exactly the policy of the American neocons, who have in their hands, in the person of Victoria Nuland and many other high-level officials in the State Department and elsewhere in the administration. They have control of U.S. foreign policy and are pointing it in a most self-destructive direction.
Don DeBar, let's wrap up the program with your final thoughts on the same topic.
I will just amplify what was just said very eloquently by saying, I'm not so sure it's stupidity, but, you know, given the stakes, absolute insanity, it's difficult to try to read the mind of a crazy person, but trying to predict the behavior of a collective of sociopathy and worse that currently makes policy in the West is both frightening and unfortunately impossible, at least for me.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Austin in New York, and independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels. Special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., the Supreme Court has been wary of weakening Section 230 to allow lawsuits against internet giants and technology firms. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Los Angeles Times has covered this story and tells us more. Several Supreme Court justices said on Tuesday, 21st of February, that they were wary of allowing lawsuits against YouTube and other social media firms over algorithms they use to direct users to related content, even if that encourages terrorists or promotes illegal conduct. The Supreme Court justices had agreed for the first time to hear a challenge to Section 230. The federal law that shields websites from being sued over content posted by others. That set off alarms at big technology firms. But during Tuesday's arguments, Justices Elena Kagan and Brett Kavanaugh said Congress, and not the court, should decide whether to change the law. You know, these are not like the nine greatest experts on the internet, Justice Elena Kagan said to Laughter, referring to the nine Supreme Court justices. She said it was very difficult to draw a line between ordinary algorithms that tell users they may be interested in similar videos and those that encourage certain individuals to look at suspect or harmful content. Isn't drawing the line something for Congress and not the court? She asked. Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh said he too thought this might be a time for judicial restraint. He said dozens of technology firms and business groups had warned that changing Section 230 would crash the digital economy with all sorts of effects on workers and consumers, retirement plans and what have you, and those are serious concerns. He said Congress was in a better position to revise its own law if needed, particularly when courts of law have upheld Section 230 as a broad legal shield since 1996. Are we really the right body to draw back from that understanding? He asked, strongly suggesting he thought the answer was no. Chief Justice John Roberts was also wary of opening the door to lawsuits. While the case before the court concerned terrorism, he said it could lead to a wave of lawsuits based on personal or business complaints. Other justices admitted they were confused and uncertain about the arguments before them. It did not sound as if a majority were ready to rule for the California parents suing Google and YouTube over the death of their daughter in a 2015 terrorist attack in Paris, France. The case of Gonzalez versus Google asked whether YouTube could be held liable for using computerized programs that recommended terrorist videos to potential recruits. A federal judge in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal threw out that claim on the grounds that Section 230 shielded online sites from being sued over content posted by others. A lawyer for the family of Noemi Gonzalez argued on Tuesday, 21st of February, that Google, which owns YouTube, should be subject to a lawsuit because of its own actions. It was encouraging people to look at ISIS videos, said Eric Schnapper, a University of Washington law professor. Professor Schnapper explained he was referring to YouTube feature that shows a list of similar or related videos to the one on screen. Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart, representing the Justice Department and the Biden administration, took the side of the plaintiffs, but stressed that the social media sites could not be sued over terrorist-made ISIS videos appearing on their platforms. Rather, they should be liable for targeted recommendations that encourage potential recruits to view similar terrorist-made ISIS videos. Both ran into mostly skeptical questions, including from Justice Clarence Thomas. In the past, Justice Thomas has argued that websites should not be shielded from liability if they knowingly post illegal or defamatory conduct and refuse to remove it. But that issue was not presented in Tuesday's case. Justice Clarence Thomas said on Tuesday he was not convinced by the plaintiff's argument that YouTube recommends videos to users. Someone interested in cooking is shown other videos related to cooking. I see those as suggestions and not recommendations, he said. The outcome may become clearer on Wednesday, 22nd of February, when the justices hear a related case involving a 2016 law that allows victims of international terrorism to sue those who knowingly aided and abetted the terrorists. That in turn led to several lawsuits against YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter that arose from ISIS-sponsored terrorist incidents. The plaintiffs in that case argued that social media sites aided the terrorists who carried out an attack in Istanbul, Turkey. Lawsuits for Twitter said the lawsuit should be dismissed because there was no evidence that Twitter postings had any effect on the terrorists who carried out the crime in Istanbul. CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. Supreme Court justices voiced hesitation on Tuesday, 21st of February, about upending a key legal shield that protects technology companies from liability for their users' posts and for how the companies moderate messages on their websites. Justices across the ideological spectrum expressed concern with breaking the delicate balance set by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act as they rule on the pivotal case, Gonzalez versus Google, even as some suggested a narrower reading of the liability shield could sometimes make sense. The current case was brought by the family of an American killed in a 2015 terrorist attack in Paris, France. The petitioners argued that Google, through its subsidiary YouTube, violated the Anti-Terrorism Act by aiding and abetting ISIS terrorists, also known as Daesh terrorists, as it promoted the group's videos through its recommendation algorithm. Lower courts of law sided with Google, saying Section 230 protects the company from being held liable for third-party content posted on its service. The petitioners contend that YouTube's recommendations actually constitute the company's own speech, which would fall outside the bounds of the liability shield. But the Supreme Court justices struggled to understand where the petitioner's counsel, Eric Schnapper, was drawing the line on what counts as content created by YouTube itself. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito at one point said he was completely confused by the distinction that Schnapper tried to draw between YouTube's own speech and that of a third party. Schnapper repeatedly pointed to the thumbnail image YouTube chose users to display what video is coming up next, or is suggested based on their views. He said that thumbnail was a joint creation between YouTube and the third party that posted the video. In this case, the terrorist group ISIS, also known as Daesh, because YouTube contributes the URL. But several chief court justices questioned whether that argument would apply to any attempt to organize information from the internet, including a search engine results page. They expressed concern that such a broad interpretation could have far-reaching effects the High Court may not be prepared to predict. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh noted that courts have applied Section 230 consistently since its inception in the 1990s, and pointed to the amici beliefs that warned overhauling the interpretation would cause massive economic consequences for many businesses, as well as their workers, consumers, and investors. Chief Justice Kavanaugh said, "Those are serious concerns Congress could consider if it sought to rework the statute." But the Supreme Court, he said, is not equipped to account for that.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up...